Flashback? Flashback?
Rufio! Rufio!
Flashbacks.
All day I've had this strong desire, raging from within. You can say that my heart's on fire.
Somewhere between.
Keep your hands on where I can see them, man.
Hey, it's 21st century, man. I don't know what I can do.
Flashbacks.
You are a sick individual and you need to be put out of your misery.
Flashback? Flashback?
Hello, everybody out there in podcast land and, of course, Facebook land. And welcome to the Front Row Network's Flashback, a part of NPR Illinois' Community Voices, where we get all nostalgia-like about the movies from our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s that have helped shape the way we look at cinema and pop culture today, and how these movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives. If you have ever thought about being the best detective in the city that only exists in primary colors, I feel bad for the colorblind people, and chasing down a world full of mobsters with crazy faces, with a prepubescent sidekick at your side, or just simply wanting more, then you, of course, are thinking about Dick Tracy. We are here to talk about this flashback of a movie. We're going back to 1990. I have some thoughts. I know these guys have some thoughts. But before we get into everything, I got to introduce the crew. First up, my flashback time-traveling partner, Jay Hoffman. How you doing, Jay?
Oh, just great. Earlier when we were chatting about this movie and doing yard work, one of the passenger windows of my van was shattered. and even that was more enjoyable than the experience of watching this movie. So, What a great day it's been so far.
This is going to be great. And today we are actually doing a crossover episode. I am so excited about this. We are teaming up with Lou Hare from the Front Row Guilty Pleasures, because if you haven't seen this movie, you will fully understand by the end of this podcast why you need to see it and why it is a guilty pleasure. We did this with Gremlins 2. We had fun with that. I can't wait to talk to and get Lou's opinions. But Lou Hare is with us. Hey, Lou, how's it going?
It is delightful. I love it whenever I can drag anyone down into the mud with me and watch a movie that makes them hate themselves just a little bit inside. So cheers. Thank you for that. Sorry, Jay, but also not sorry, and you're welcome.
Just wait, Jay, until we start talking about the soundtrack. Rounding out our panel tonight is a frequent collaborator on the Front Row Network. We love her here on Flashbacks. We got Miss Erin McCabe here.
I don't have a cool background like you guys for everyone who's here on Facebook Live. I'm just the back of my house and my Bloodsport shirt. That's all I got.
Out on a street myself. This is not a background.
I'm just promoting.
Yeah, what background are you talking about? This is
you guys are so fancy. You're too fancy for me.
I'm on the balcony of my house. What are you talking about? This is
Lou, you look like you're in Cool World.
Oh God. I don't think this could get worse.
I genuinely don't know if that's an upgrade or not.
We're gonna, not only are we doing crossover episodes, we're gonna crossover movies.
She may have named the only movie I dislike more than this one.
Well, we are here today to talk about Dick Tracy, a movie that has not aged well, but you can remember watching it and you were just so encapsulated by it. But let's break it down. Jay, tell us what the movie's all about.
All right. Dick Tracy is a masterful private detective among morons in a city full of bright, never-changing colors. He's waging a war against Alfonso Big Boy Caprice and the rest of his oddly faced mobster cohorts to finally bring peace to the city. Tracy is fighting to protect a material girl in order to have her give eyewitness testimony that could finally put Big Boy away. Along the way, there's kidnapping, murder, Tommy gun battles in the middle of the streets, romance, and a mysteriously masked individual whose face looks like a testicle. In the end, Dick Tracy saves the day and inspires legions of 90s kids to solve their problems with machine guns and murder.
Thank you, Jay. You know, it's always great because Jay's our script doctor, and you can always tell when he really likes a movie and when he really does not like a movie. So thank you for that, Jay.
It's a really good testicle mask.
Let's just break down. What?
It's such special effects in this film.
You know, I think I want to go as the blank or the testicle as Halloween now. let's talk the movie in general. Aaron's got some fun facts about Dick Tracy. Let's hear them.
Fun facts. And if, as always, Lou usually brings the receipts, so feel free to chime in, Lou.
I got a stack of them.
All right.
Stacks of receipts. Tax accountant.
So Dick Tracy is directed by Warren Beatty. And my understanding is this film actually went through a handful of people before it landed with him directing and producing the film. It was written by also several people, but mainly the characters created by Truster Gold, who is the original creator of Dick Tracy, Jim Cash and Jack Epps, who I believe are of Top Gun notoriety. This movie stars Warren Beatty. It's actually a really packed cast. Warren Beatty, Al Pacino, Madonna, Dustin Hoffman, Charlie Cosmo, Mandy Patinkin. I'm sorry if I said her name incorrectly.
That's Viggo Montoya from The Princess Bride.
Oh my gosh, 88 Keys. 88 Keys. Okay, thank you. It's been a long weekend over here. Paul Sorvino, Dick Van Dyke, James Caan, Kathy Bates, Catherine O'Hara, Glenn Headley. Half these people you can't recognize anyway because of the special effects and the makeup. The release date was June 15th, 1990. It had a $47 million budget. It grossed $103 million in the U.S. and cumulatively worldwide, only about $162 million. It's got a Rotten Tomatoes score of 63%. And another little fun fact, since we are on NPR Illinois, Dick Tracy was created in 1931 by Truster Gold, who is from Woodstock, Illinois. And for those of you movie lovers like us in the front row, know that Woodstock is also famous for being the location where Groundhog Day was filmed. And for you book nerds out there and movie nerds, Orson Welles grew up there as well. The initial premiere of Dick Tracy was held in Woodstock. And so this, let's see. Dick Tracy started as a comic strip, for those of you who don't know. We talked about this before this podcast started. We're like, who actually knows about Dick Tracy now? Who reads the comics in the paper anymore either? That's a serious question to ask. It's been a long time for me. People usually don't get actual physical papers now. So Dick Tracy was a comic strip. It showed up in the Sunday paper and the daily paper. It was started in the Detroit Mirror. It was written and drawn by Truster Gold until 1977. Weird little thing, in the 1960s, they kind of experimented with doing stories of Dick Tracy in space. Since we were in the space race during that time, he took in his investigations into space and on the moon. And in the 70s, he came back to Earth onto the streets, but this time with a porn stash and a hippie sidekick. Dick Tracy also had his own radio serial. He had multiple serialized movies and feature films between the 1930s and the 1950s. You might have to do another crossover with Brandon from Classics on those.
No, I'm good.
The film was nominated, even though this is guilty pleasures, it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards.
That's nuts. I keep going. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Winning 3 of them, which, Lou, hold on to your head, which winning 3 of them ties it with Black Panther for the most statues won by a comic book movie.
Yes, it does.
These awards mean nothing.
It's true. 2003, AFI's 100 Years, 100 Heroes and Villains, Dick Tracy was nominated as a hero. In 2004, it made AFI's 100 Years, 100 Songs, nominated for Sooner or Later, I Always Get My Man. And in 2006, it was nominated for AFI's Greatest Movie Musical.
Just because you have Stephen Sondheim write your lyrics for your songs does not make this movie a musical.
No.
That last one is bunk. Anyway. Okay. So let's do what we always do here at the front, flashbacks. Let's flashback. When was the first time that you guys remember seeing Dick Tracy? Aaron, I'm going to go ahead with you. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Okay. Well, so I saw Dick Tracy in the theater. This movie came out in 1990. I was 8. I was telling Jay on another podcast, really between like 1988 and 19, probably like 92. That was like when me and my brother and sister and the kids, it was like, if it was raining, you went to the movie theater. So it was raining. My mom packed me and a couple of the other kids on the block up, and we went to the theater and saw Dick Tracy. And when I rewatched this movie, I realized I literally remembered nothing from this film as a kid, except for the watch, the color scheme, and when they put Lips Manless in the bath, which disturbed me and stressed me out as an 8-year-old. And Madonna, I remember Madonna. But yeah, I saw it in the theater when my parents were in the heat of making inappropriate movie choices for me and my brother and sister.
Now my question is, did you go to McDonald's and get the wristwatch Happy Meal?
I'm sure I begged for it, because that I remember the ad campaign, and I think we're going to get into this later, but like I remember the heavy duty marketing campaign of the toys and everything like that. And yeah, that watch was like super bad.
All right, Lou, what are your first memories when it comes to Dick Tracy?
Honestly, the first memories that I have of it are not of the film, but of the marketing. So for context, just to add on to all the great stuff Aaron said. So keep in mind, this is 1990. We're a year removed from Batman. Mm-hmm. Batman changed everything. Batman changed the game in terms of not just a movie event, but the marketing, the crossovers, the musical ties, the soundtrack, everything. It was this complete, like, plaster the earth with Batman stuff. And Batman ended up making $411 million worldwide. So, and selling boatloads of toys and merchandise along the way. So Disney has Dick Tracy already in production as Batman's hitting. And I think that you're going to hear me like go back to this well a lot, but one of the things that they did was they rolled out a massive publicity, marketing, merchandise campaign. I remember in daycare, kids having Dick Tracy merchandise before the movie came out.
Yes.
Because it looked super cool. Like it was stylish and it was colorful. And so I knew more about Dick Tracy like the weeks preceding up to the movie. And then I never got around to actually seeing it in the theater, because I was at the age where I only got to see movies that my parents were willing to sit through. And this movie being kind of marketed like a cartoon come to life did not appeal to them. Did they take me to see Die Hard 2? You bet your ass they did. But did they take me to see Dick Tracy? No, they did not. Why? Because my dad wanted to see Die Hard 2, not Dick Tracy. It had nothing to do with me. God bless him, though. Much, much better choice in retrospect. So I saw this eventually on home video. It then got played like in heavy rotation on Showtime. I don't know if the first time I saw it, I watched it all the way through, or if my just memory has me watching it in bits and pieces and then, you know, 40-minute chunks of it at a time or whatever. But I saw it a ton on cable afterwards. And it was one of those things that you'd pop on as a kid and be like, oh, yeah, I can watch this for a little bit and walk away from it. So I was never like a huge fan. In fact, my best memory of it was the Nintendo game that came along with this. That's my favorite tie-in. That game, by the way, hard as hell. Anybody who tells you they beat that game without a game genie is a liar. Straight up. But it was fun. It really captured the spirit of the movie. Like, you solved crimes, you picked up clues, you interrogated people. It was really good movie video game, which was rare those days. So I liked the movie and had a tie into that. And then, yeah, we'll get into my thoughts now, 30 years later, but I'll leave it at that for there.
All right. Thanks, Lou. All right, Jay. I want to hear your thoughts.
You hear my first memory? My first memory, much like
last
Lou.
Last week?
Well, that's my first viewing. It's not my first memory. My first memory is the same as Lou's. I wanted that damn watch. I wanted that walkie-talkie watch so bad. I remember that. I very vividly remember that. I remember the bright colors of it, but never saw it. I think it's probably similar thing to Lou. Whatever my parents decide we're going to see, that's what we go see. And I don't know if I wanted to see this or not. I just remember the watch, man. That's the thing I remembered. And you said the video game was hard as hell, so much like watching this movie. It has that in common. I needed
the game
was
much more engaging than the film.
Because of the plot.
Yeah, this week was the first time I watched it. And I say this week because it literally took me a week because I kept falling asleep. I fell asleep 3 different times trying to watch this movie, and I had to start over on parts, which is even more cruel than staying awake and just watching it in one fell swoop. So I also have things to say, but I like what Lou said with the Batman stuff. This movie seemed like it should have had Who Framed Roger Rabbit sensibilities, but it tried to steal everything from Batman, and then it was just wildly confused because,
including Danny Elfman.
Yeah, it's very, very,
a lot of undertones there.
Very tonally confusing, there were parts where I kept going like, this is a kids movie? This does not seem like a kids movie. A lot of murder.
Yeah, seems like a kids movie. Like, we'll go to the theater and see that. But I mean, like, they also took me to see Beetlejuice at the theater, which was terribly inappropriate at the time.
Yeah, but it doesn't try to pretend like it's a kids movie. They're like, if we put fancy makeup on their faces, it won't be weird if we put them in a block of concrete and drop them in the lake.
Oh, well, okay, here's the thing, too. Like, I was familiar with Dick Tracy, like, because I read, like, that was the thing. I went over to my grandparents, and I would read the comics in the paper. So, like, I was familiar with the comic, what the, like, drawings of the characters looked like. I can't remember if I actually wanted to see the movie because of that or the ad campaign. But, like, when I saw it, 8-year-old me was disturbed by the way that they looked. Like, I was like, oh, this is all too much. It's everyone screaming, and they look funny, and it's very terrifying for an 8-year-old child.
I will say my first, like, 10 minutes, I was like, oh, this is like Sin City, like way before Sin City came out. And then 10 minutes later, I was like, nope. I was wrong.
It's Sin City Junior is what it is.
Yeah. Like Sin City for kids.
For kids. Well, yeah. Ish.
Kind of, yeah.
There were a lot of kids who probably saw this in the theater who turned out to really, really like Madonna. Probably for the reasons not attributed to her acting or her singing, but we'll get into that. My first memories of watching Dick Tracy are probably like 1993. The only thing I remember, like all of you, is the campaign and the toys. I remember they did a thing with Happy Meals because we had a few and I remembered them. One was the watch, but it was just one that was plastic. It didn't work. It just like flipped open. And then you could have like little figurine of Dick Tracy and the blank, or as Jay liked to call him, the testicle. Yeah, I just remember those toys and playing with them, and then watching the movie. I distinctly remember because it was TBS, and you know, I always remember TBS didn't really have a lot of shows. They had a lot of baseball, but they didn't really have a lot of movies. And I just remember watching it with my dad one night. And then when I got older, I rented it and I watched them. Like, this is a lot different than what was on TV. And yes, the rest is history. So let's talk about the movie in general. Let's talk about our favorite scenes before we talk about what we liked, what we didn't like. So favorite scenes, let's just go ahead. I'm going to start it off and just kick it off. I really enjoyed the scene where, Breathless Mahoney, played by Madonna, comes in and talks to Dick Tracy.
I bet you did.
Right.
I'm sure
you to him, crawled on his desk seductively. Again, kids movie, so maybe she was just trying to emulate a cat. I don't know. I don't know what Warren Beatty told her for direction here.
Here's what he said. He said, hey, do that thing that we were doing before the cameras were rolling. That's what he did. So for those of you, also any of our younger viewers or listeners, just so you know, Warren Beatty and Madonna were dating throughout the production. They were actually together before this movie started shooting, which is one of the reasons that Madonna is in this movie. And they dated more or less throughout the release of this film, and they eventually broke up in about 91. But they were like the hot couple for about a year and about 2 years there. And so, yeah, when it also came out, there was that whole, oh, this is the new Hollywood it couple, and they did a movie together. And so much was made about their chemistry, as opposed to, you know, Dick Tracy's love interest in the film.
Right.
Because it gets very, like, it's steamy. It's steamy every time they're on screen together. But just that one scene, just doing my rewatch, when he puts the earrings in the glass, I mean, just everything about that scene with the color work and the cinematography and just the production design, just really, it really struck home. I really liked the camera work with the movie. There's a lot of close-ups. It just did something for the movie, because it kind of felt like this right here with Dick Tracy. I kind of got that sentiment. But that's a scene that really, really stuck out. I also enjoyed when Dick Tracy rescued the kid from that oaf in the shack, and they were fighting, and the shack just kept tilting. I thought that was great comic relief. But let's hear from you guys. Lou, let's hear some of your favorite scenes.
Well, I think the first one that comes to mind that was actually, I think the one that was maybe the most charming to me was actually, first of all the scenes I think with the kid work really well. He was an excellent child actor. Charlie Cosmo, who I don't believe is actually an actor anymore. I think he went into law, if I'm remembering that correctly. So he does an excellent job as this street urchin that Dick Tracy just kind of decides, hey, you're my kid now, because that's a thing. We'll talk a little bit about that later, but there's a montage of how the kid just can never stop eating, and whatever they're doing, it's when do we eat, and anybody who has kids knows that feeling, that basically being a parent is driving your kid around to different things and then them telling you, I'm hungry, when do we eat? So that one, that's the most honest scene in the whole movie. So that scene stuck out to me. The rest of it, I think, is kind of in little bits and pieces. So I think as we sprinkle in, I'll talk a little bit more about it. But I don't know if we're going to talk a lot about the kid, because we got a lot of other things to get to. So at least we got him in at that point. So that'll do it for me for now.
All right, Aaron, what are some of your favorite scenes?
Okay, just like, because Ryan, I know you're such a cinematography guy, like, and we were talking earlier, this movie had like heavy, heavy hitters in it. Okay. Like, they came out of the gates with, like you said, Danny Elfman for the soundtrack. I'm a big soundtrack person. So like, you got the guy who did Batman, you have the cinematographer, Vittorio Storano, who did Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
okay, that's the guy who shot this film. And so it's, I really appreciate, okay, I'm going to just say this right now online. I'm going to be honest with everybody. I rewatched this movie today and I was like, I'm actually really enjoying it. I really liked it. I had a good time with it. But I think it's because the cinematography, I love the fact that they really used, they stuck with the studio lots. So most of the scenery in this movie is all studio lots. And I thought that was so cool, like such an homage to the 30s films. And then obviously stuck with the color scheme of the comics. So for me, what I like, what you were saying about like, Jay, about like, when I was watching this, it was like, oh, like how much of this did, like, it's Sin City Jr. Obviously it came first, but I love watching movies based on comics and seeing where I can pick out a scene that looks like it came off the page with the shadowing and the negative space and the color use and everything. So for me, I don't have a specific favorite scene, I think it's more or less the scenes where I can look at that and say, that's right off the page of a comic that I'm reading while I'm sitting at the table with my grandpa. You know what I mean?
Oh,
it's gorgeous to look at.
Oh yeah.
I think that is of all the things you can say about the movie. I mean, watching it now in HD, which is the first, I mean, I clearly had only ever seen it on cable television. So, you know, to see it in its full form, like it looks great. I agree with you, Aaron. I think it's the aesthetic is beautiful. What they put in around it, we can get into.
Right.
But there's some tableaus and just some, you know, like these backgrounds that we're using. They're just, it's just beautiful colors.
This was the first movie to actually stop using painted scenery. So like the scene that is behind Lou and behind Jay, that would be like a backdrop. This is the last studio movie to ever do that. The rest of after this, it was all CGI. So, I mean, they really hit home with old Hollywood because, you know, this is a movie that's supposed to be set in 1930s. Lou, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was just going to say, because Aaron, you had mentioned about all of the actors that are in it. You know, I think we are of a generation that maybe missed out on Warren Beatty, like the Warren Beatty.
Yeah.
Warren Beatty, like, was one of the biggest movie stars in the 70s. And he was friends with everybody. Yep. And so he called in like every favor he had to get all of these people. There are 9 people in this movie that have either won or not, were nominated for Academy Awards. That's like Endgame level awards cred, and you know, so like it's kind of stunning in that, and him calling those favors in, and like Dustin Hoffman said, he basically did this as a favor to Warren Beatty, and I think he wouldn't be the only one. So yeah, we'll get into it later, but it's Warren Beatty using up every last one of his Hollywood favors for Dick Tracy.
Well, let's hear from Jay. Let's see what his favorite scene was. I think it's the one where he closed his eyes, but Jay, go ahead.
Yes, what a hill to die on for Warren Beatty. this is the one. I wholeheartedly agree that this movie is super cool to look at, which is why I think, like, I don't usually like just like full out hate a movie, but I hate this movie. Wow. And I think it feels like there's just so much there, so much potential there. Man, this movie was awesome looking, absolutely awesome. And even with the backdrops and then how they had the actors in, I was like, how'd they do that? You know, this is a movie made 30, and I'm like, wow. It's so fluid looking. It's so gorgeous. And then to have the story and the acting that splattered against all that beauty that they created, just I think it just made me mad because it felt like a wasted opportunity. So this is one of the most visually appealing and striking movies I think I've ever seen. I think it's absolutely gorgeous. And making fun of the Academy Awards it won, you know, what was it? Once costume design and I think
production. Hold on.
One of the ones that won is for song, and you can give Stephen Sondheim an Oscar. I'm cool with that.
Yeah,
I don't care what the movie is for.
But the other two are technical.
Call it a musical. Come on.
But it had a bunch of technical nominations, which honestly, it did deserve those.
Well, it has one I know we're definitely going to talk about in a couple of minutes. I'm very excited to
go. Crazy to me.
let's jump right into it. I mean, we're talking Academy Awards. This movie was nominated for 7, so I'm sure we're going to talk about this when we talk about takeaways. So, takeaways. This movie was nominated for 7 Academy Awards. It was cinematography, as Aaron mentioned. It was nominated for Best Costume, Best Sound, Best Art Direction, which it won. So, you know, art direction in the 90s would be our production design now. Best Makeup, so all the weird faces. And then, of course, it won Best Song for Stephen Sondheim, which was sooner or later I get my man. So we
what else was out that year? Lou, I need the receipts on that. What other song came out in 1990 that's the one that won?
Well, I'll have to look up. I know 1990 is the year in terms of the big nominees that year. That was the year that Dances with Wolves won and Goodfellas was nominated and Godfather 3. In terms of original song, give me a minute. You guys talk. I'll have some receipts for you in a minute. Can I talk about some numbers here?
Can I talk about the makeup?
Yeah, go ahead.
Award. I don't think the makeup had to have been bad. And what I mean by that is I think with the right story and the right tone, the makeup would have worked with the movie. But I feel like the direction that this went, I didn't feel like the makeup worked for me. I get that he's trying to make him look like a comic book. That's to make this story a little more kid appealing, but I don't know. The tone of this movie made it really hard for me to deal with the makeup faces. And
can I ask you a question about that?
Tell her no. Tell her no.
Tell me no. It's okay. can I ask you a question about that? So like, is that 2020? Is 2020 Jay is saying like, hey, the makeup doesn't work. But in 1990, do we look at that and go, oh my God, this is amazing. It looks just like a comic book. Do you know what I'm saying? What do you think about that? Do you think you're judging?
Is that what I would say or what we would say?
Either or. I'm broaching the question.
I don't know.
Because I feel like in 1990, my God, this is amazing.
I never watched the movie until this week, right? I've only seen clips, and I've always seen, and I'm like, what in the hell is going on with the makeup? Anytime I've ever seen it, that's been like, what is this movie possibly be about when it's about a detective?
Okay, before we get too deep into that, the accountant is, I've done my work. I've got some receipts for you here. Okay, so the other nominees for best song that year. And Aaron, prepare to get mad. I'm gonna ramp up to the ones. Okay, first of all, Promise Me You'll Remember from Godfather Part 3. Whatever. I'm Checking Out from Postcards from the Edge. Okay. Somewhere in My Memory from Home Alone by John Williams. Or Blaze of Glory, John Bon Jovi, Young Guns 2. Stephen Sondheim 1, John Bon Jovi 0. Suck it, Jersey.
Baby was calling in lots of favors. So
yeah, that's true. That's
really, we got to get some awards here.
back on the topic of makeup. I mean, but to think, like, okay, so you have all these funny characters with these weird names. Flat Top. You've got Prune Face. You've got, I mean, and they make this makeup flawlessly to fit that aesthetic. I mean, you cannot fault that. Yes, it is a craze and they're trying to make it look like a comic book, but when you see a Flat Top and his name is Flat Top, it works. So
we can fault that. Yeah. I just want to get that.
Here's what I'm going to say about that. I would go with you, Jay, if I thought. I don't think the makeup is bad. I think the makeup is conflicting with the performances the director is asking them to do. I think that you have a guy who has a face that literally looks like a prune, and his name is Prune Face.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not a movie for subtlety.
No.
This is like, that's like, we are literally taking a comic strip that has zero depth to it, and we're trying to like make a flesh out a movie around it. And Beatty's choice is to make this like an homage to 1930s noir with a dude with a prune face. And the two ideas are conflicting. And so, like, I hear what you're saying, Jay, but I was like, I would be fine with it if they were acting. It's okay if they look like cartoons, if they act like cartoons.
I think that's what I was trying to say. I think you just said it much smarter than me. I think that's what I was saying when I said the tone of the movie didn't match the makeup didn't match the tone for me. And
Right, because you got like a guy like, I think that is William Forsythe as Flat Top.
Yes.
Who's a great like grizzled kid. That dude does grizzled as well as anybody. And you've got him in like a Flat Top and Carrot Top wig. And he's acting all gritty. And I'm like, no, like it's not matching. It's not, nothing like that doesn't go. And so I would agree with you there. And it's topped off by the fact that like Beatty is playing this movie so straight.
Yes.
He is taking this so seriously while he is running around in a cartoon background, fighting guys like Pruneface and the blank. That's where I think the disconnect is. And I think that'll get us down a lot of different roads.
Well, and that's why when we were talking, it's like, I keep bringing in like this movie, you've got Dick Tracy or Warren Beatty, who's playing the hell out of the role and kind of has the same attitude of Brad Pitt in Cool World. Kind of
what he's like the Cool World. I thought you would bring it up just to get me right.
Gotta watch Cool World. Stop fighting it and just watch Cool.
Aaron is secretly on the Paramount payroll and gets like a $10 every time she works in Cool World.
At least this movie's cool to look at. Cool World was not. I can't. Why do you always bring it up?
I love Cool World. Stop it, Jay.
If we do it on Guilty Pleasures, will we be able to retire Cool World talk conversations?
We can.
Because I'm willing to jump on that grenade.
Let's take that into, you know, we're talking about the makeup and the acting. We should jump into the acting and the one performance I really want to talk about, since it was one of the nominated for an Academy Award, Al Pacino.
I stretched for this part of the conversation.
I want to hear the defense of this, because there's no way you're going to convince me. You're the most convincing guy we have on the network.
You know what? I loved Pacino. I actually, the more the movie went on, the more I enjoyed Pacino's role.
Oh.
He is the only person who knows what this movie should have been from the beginning. The only one. And that's why his performance is so jarring, because no one else is doing what he's doing, but everybody should be doing what he's doing. He is the only one who realizes he's in a cartoon world and he should be acting like a cartoon.
Yeah.
Like it's in, and he's chewing scenery. And by the way, context is important. I think also, we look at Pacino now and we think Pacino, you know, and this is the genesis of that, because up until this point in his career, he was like serious actor Pacino. Like aside from Scarface, he was like prestige actor, yada, yada, yada. This was like the first time he cuts loose in a movie. And so at the time it was like, oh my gosh, Pacino's just like hamming it up. That's so unlike him.
Well, the best part about this with Pacino is he designed the makeup and his costume. So everything about Big Boy Caprice, he had a hand in. So like it's almost like he was fully invested.
And
like
he went method for this.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, why not? You know, and it's like,
because it's 1990 and Al Pacino still gave shit in 1990.
Let me say this. I get what you're saying. I still think he was terrible. Yeah. And the one thing I want to say is I always thought it was like Scent of a Woman. That's the one where his stuff. Then I was watching this. I'm like, didn't this come out before Scent of a Woman? Why does everybody always reference that as the movie is the change? Because this feels like the movie
Because Scent of a Woman is what got him the Oscar. But I would argue he doesn't get Scent of a Woman unless he gets nominated for an Oscar for Dick Tracy.
Nailed it.
And well, then I would like, also argue, did he deserve an Oscar for Scent of a Woman?
Oh, 100%.
There's an argument there.
No. He did. No. I mean, I believe Denzel Washington should have won for Malcolm X that year. But I would agree this starts the wheel in motion for Pacino, like slowly descending into Pacino-esque, you know, Pacino with the exclamation mark after him, you know, because I mean, the dude was Michael Corleone, like he's an amazing actor, amazing. But like, this was that thing with, he'd never won an Oscar. He kept losing. Like, he lost Godfather. He lost Godfather 2. He'd done all these great films. He lost for this, which is fine. He lost, by the way, to Joe Pesci.
In Goodfellas. You know,
so it, Scorsese won, comic book movie zero.
Deal with it, Craigers, man.
Ruthless tonight. So,
no, but he, yeah, but like, he starts getting like rewarded for going broader. Like, we, like his, like that little like id just started getting fed, and it just like grew and grew and grew. And then the next thing you know, he's like, you know, in Devil's Advocate, screaming at Keanu Reeves for a three way. <It's> just we go down. It's a slippery slope, is what I'm saying.
It is. For sure.
Hey, well, can we do something real quick? Because we tried to have Aaron do a Bill Murray impression on Caddyshack. Can we hear your Al Pacino?
Okay, so here's what I want you to do. I'm gonna emulate Pacino from the scene that the first scene where he comes in hot, where he's coaching Madonna.
Yeah,
and more. He's just basically yelling the lyrics. So somebody go ahead, start talking about something that they like about the movie, and Big Boy's gonna come in and we'll
okay
back you up.
So the seven main primary colors that this movie used are red, yellow, then the
yellow,
purple, green, and what was it? Black.
Right here, black. Hole. Oh.
But I mean, all these colors are flushed throughout the whole. I mean, all the buildings
flushed throughout the movie.
I can't even do this with a straight face.
Think about how Madonna must have felt.
Right.
I'll tell you how Madonna felt.
Yeah. This is great.
Can't you see? I love you.
I wonder what it's like for Warren Beatty to see, you know, Pacino just slapping Madonna's tush.
That's a good point.
Oh, man. Okay.
Pacino, okay, but part of the writing, it, unless it was improv, somebody help me, but you are right, Lou. I feel like even the lines he had as the movie went on, like Pacino's role, like he's constantly quoting presidents, generals.
Wrong.
Yes,
he's doing it wrong.
Yes, exactly. Like he's doing it wrong, and then the way he's talking to himself and he's having this banter back and forth, I thought was hilarious, and I really enjoyed it.
I mean, yeah. I mean, everything about his characterization was fantastic. I mean,
for a movie that can be as dull as this movie gets, this look, Jay, I understand you, but I will tell you this. Can you at least say that when he's on screen, you're at least engaged in what's going on?
Are you saying those were the scenes I wasn't falling asleep? I would say probably, but I also will say this. I think I out loud, while my wife probably also fell asleep on the couch, was going, what the hell is this? What are we doing? So okay. Like a lot of that conversation. That was me Pacinoing Pacino back at him while watching the movie, I think.
I have a question for you, Jay. in our chat, I asked, is there any other actor that is that committed and that Pacino-y that in that scene where they're rehearsing for more, 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 can you see any other actor doing that part in the way that Lou demonstrated for us?
I think so.
I'm waiting.
Think somebody who was robbed of an Oscar nomination last year. I think somebody like Adam Sandler could probably do the same amount of work.
What?
You just compared one of the most committed actors ever to one of the least committed actors ever.
Committed.
Sandler's not doing this movie unless they're shooting it in Jamaica and David Spade's playing Dick Tracy. That's the only way he's doing this movie.
Now that's a movie. No, Rob Schneider.
I'm not comparing Pacino. No. I'm comparing
Rob
this
Schneider
performance.
Is prune face and he'll like it. That's all he gets. Yeah, and he doesn't even need the makeup anymore.
And his daughter's a singer, so she can do the songs.
Can we? All right. I hate.
We're gonna talk about actors, though. I am gonna give. props to Dustin Hoffman.
Yes, Mumbles.
Who also has to act the shit out of a role, like an outbreak. Outbreak in this, there's no difference between his performance.
I guess I need to see Outbreak now.
I'm glad you said Mumbles.
He's the only good guy.
That whole scene, the interrogation scene, was, I don't know what it was, but it was just pure comedic gold. Just the way it was framed and just his beep, 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 beep. Like, it was just perfect. Like, and, you know, he's so quiet when he's not in that interrogation scene. And he, you know, it's Dustin Hoffman, so he's a commanding presence, but, you know, you just know he's there. So good call, Aaron. I want to talk about William Forsythe. I mean, as Flat Top, I mean, you know, you got Al Pacino as the villain, but then as like all these other gangsters, he is the best. I mean, with the Tommy gun, everything, like, he just oozes that villainy. And I really enjoyed watching him, you know, as an adult. I really like William Forsythe. I think he's one of the, a great, great actor. But just, I mean, he's just that grin that he had. I mean, it's just awesome. So anything else that we want to talk about when it comes to acting?
Well, I guess let's open this up. What do we all think about Madonna's performance in this movie?
I thought she was one of the better parts. She worked for me.
Well, elaborate.
I am not only breathless, I'm speechless.
Jay, is it because that she was wearing a see-through negligee in a PG movie?
No, and I have to say, so far, since I've been a co-host, you bring all those scenes up and everybody, yes, we do. So don't throw that back on me, pervert. No, I don't know. I thought she was fine, and I don't think she was going to get nominated for an Academy Award too. I thought she was perfectly fine in it. I thought she was playing Madonna in it, but I thought she was fine, and it didn't. I don't know. I don't know.
See, here's the thing.
Struggle so hard with the tone of this movie, and the
right. And that's, I think that's my point. And I don't know if I want to fault Madonna at this or if I want to fault Warren Beatty. But where I disagree with you, Jay, is like, she's not being Madonna, because Madonna in her real performance and persona has a cheekiness to her.
Yeah,
that is absent in this movie and could have been sorely used in this movie. Like, she's supposed to be like the, you know, the vamp, the, you know, the, you know, lady killer kind of type. And she's like, it's subdued and it's so odd.
Yeah.
It's very natural.
Right. In a movie that has a fake set, like, that is a car. Like, again,
we're going to keep,
yeah, we're going to keep going back to like Beatty wanting like some naturalistic performances in an unnatural world that he's creating. It's so jarring. And like, Madonna's like the best example of that, because I get why Beatty would want to play the straight man as Dick Tracy. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, but if he's the straight man, then every other character around him should be not straight. They should have some heighten to them. And the only people that have heightened sensibilities to them, honestly, are Al Pacino and Dustin Hoffman. Like, even the other villains, like, they're all like, everybody's playing this way too straight to make this movie as fun as it could be.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's why it's hard to judge the performances. It's all so muddled and confused. Like you said, the direction he wanted the acting, some were over the top, some were subdued. I think the story we're trying to tell a really, to be honest, I mean, it's an intense story. It's the Untouchables for kids, you know. It's, he's trying to clean the streets of gangs, but there's gunfights and machine guns and scantily clad women, but it's a kids movie. Like, all the different parts of this make it very hard to
be fair to Ryan. The scene he's talking about, it's worth noting, regardless of your own personal feelings about Madonna, Ryan, which we'll save for the Slack chat. She is topless in part of this movie. there's that movie where there's like, she's not like, and I think that was a mistake. I think they made, that was a movie that was, that's something that HD uncovers quite literally that I don't think you would notice in any other frame because yeah, like what is she doing? Why am I seeing Madonna's nipple in a Disney movie?
Like, right.
That shouldn't.
Yeah. That was my reaction rewatching. Like I never. And
it, right. And it goes to Warren Beatty to be like, how is he getting away? What's that?
Now I got to go find this nipple.
Stay tuned for Aaron's next newest podcast, Find the Nipple.
Well, it's funny because like my wife was watching. I'm like, she's naked. She goes, oh, she is. She goes, and then my wife goes, this movie's PG. I go, yep.
Yeah, it's insane. It's literally insane that no one from Disney was like, hey, Warren, can you tell your girlfriend to put on a damn bra?
Like, also, there's a really high death count in this movie as well.
But Disney, like, Disney owns it, but they didn't put their name on it. And when they found out how violent it was, I don't know if they knew about Madonna, but when they found out how the content, they gave it to Touchstone. They still own Touchstone, and they still distributed a comic.
Yeah.
Disney distributed a comic for Dick Tracy, but they took their name, their distribution, right off those opening credits. It was
The trailer says Walt Disney Pictures presents. First
one. Yep, yep.
But the film opens with the Touchstone logo, which was like Touchstone was Disney for this has some not so family friendly stuff.
Right.
So that was like their cover to get away with like riskier stuff, but still keep the Disney name pure. And then later on they buy, and then later on they buy Miramax when they wanted shit to get real. so they had like there's Disney, Touchstone, and Miramax. It's like the PG, PG-13, and R of the.
Oh, that's funny.
Of the Disney Corporation.
All right. Okay, are there any other
major about Madonna's performance? I feel like for me, I didn't feel like she was subdued. I feel like she was again trying too hard in a movie that needed her to be more ridiculous than serious. But it felt to me like was this her leveraging her way into film in the 90s? Because before this, she's obviously a prominent music star, pop star, successful music videos. But after Dick Tracy, Madonna, we get A League of Their Own, then we get Evita. So, like, is this her way that she leverages her way into more film presence?
I would agree with that, but I would add on to that. This is again the Batman conundrum because Batman had Prince, even though Prince wasn't in the movie.
Right.
They were able to do, Prince did a whole Batman album.
Right.
That went, what again was another tie into the film. And they're like, oh, well, if we get Madonna, Warren Beatty wants Madonna. Not only do we get Madonna and all the publicity around her to help sell the movie and the real life tabloid stuff that's going on, she can also then do an album. Of song tie-ins, just like Prince did for Batman. And I cannot wait to talk about that. We need to talk more about the movie first, but please, we cannot close this night out before we get to that album. But
we'll get there. We'll get to the soundtrack. So my thoughts on Madonna. This was like one of her first serious roles. I mean, her last film role was Who's That Girl from 87. Yeah. That movie is fantastic. What's his name? Loudon Clea. I mean, me and my brother would watch it on TV and just laugh hysterically. But for serious drama acting chops, she did well. I mean, and this really, I think, really helped her get a foothold and really start, you know, doing more serious work. I'm not talking Swept Away or whatever that movie was where she was on an island. But yeah, I think this was definitely a step in the right direction for her.
And it shows that she should be doing supporting roles rather than starring. That was the big mistake with Madonna, right? Is she leapt right into starring roles, and the movies that she did up until this point were trash. Because she's Madonna, so why does she need to be a supporting role? And here she is a supporting role from this. And she's, I'd agree, I don't think she's bad in the movie. I just think she's, again, like everything else, just missed. I'm just laying a lot of this at Warren Beatty's feet at this point. But yeah, but then you point out A League of Her Own, which I think is probably her best film performance.
Yeah.
And it's in a supporting role. And I think that seemed to be probably where she's better off instead of having to like carry a picture on her own.
Yeah. Is there any other major takeaways that we want to talk about before we talk about improvements and then impact, which we'll talk about Lou's soundtrack. But any major takeaways that we want to talk about before we move on?
No, I think you just all covered it. I think to go back to what Jay said earlier, it's like, who was, when they made this movie, who were they making this movie for?
They didn't know. This is the perfect segue to improvements.
Right. So yeah, that's fine. We'll go there then. So yeah,
who was this movie made for? Like, you have this adult style action and this seductive, sultry character, but this is a movie that was marketed heavily for kids. You had a toy production line. Like, this movie had a serious identity crisis. Take with it as you will.
Yeah, this movie was made for one person, Warren Beatty.
Warren Beatty.
This is a vanity project. That's
did
all this.
Did he have his own money on this film as well? Like, no, but contract, or how did that work? But he, like, if he went over budget, it was coming out of his cut.
He wasn't the producer, though, was it? I mean,
no. This was like a movie that had, like, Dick Tracy was like, they'd been working on this character and this movie for a while, as you mentioned, Darren. But I think it was just, they couldn't get anybody to do it. And Beatty said he would only do it if he got to be Dick Tracy.
Yeah. I can see that. That's very Warren Beatty.
Mm-hmm.
It really felt like, to make it a kid's movie, they threw in things, you know, like, make a kid sidekick. Let's have cool gadgets.
Yeah.
Let's have bright colors and makeup faces. And so it seems like,
and here's your Tommy gun.
Yeah. They had this idea of the movie and they're like, I know how to make it for kids, because it was a kid's, you know, radio serial program, in the '30s that kids listened to, but it's 60 years later and there's, not a great depression going on at the time. And there's not a great war coming down the road a few years. And so it's a little different time. But it feels like they thought they could just, we'll slap things in there. It'll work.
Nothing kids in 1990 loved more than Warren Beatty, film noir, and 1930s comics.
That's the perfect powder gang.
That's just a recipe to print money at that point.
I go back to that statement, like, this movie does not know what it wanted to be. And I think a lot of that is on Warren Beatty. Yes, I think this was a passion project and he wanted to do this. But he is so used to directing or being in movies that are very straight forward drama driven movies, and it's almost like he missed the mark on the kid aspect. So like Jay said, well, you have gadgets and let's just throw a kid sidekick. It's a kid's movie, but it's not, like, and it's just so confused and so muddled, because it is a beautifully shot movie. The colors, the cinematography, the way things are framed, kids are not going to give a crud about that stuff. They're not. And so he dropped the ball.
Yeah.
And then the action scenes too. Mm. Like, I can just see him like, well, when we were on Bonnie and Clyde, here's what we did. Like, that's what it felt like. Cause these were just as when violent as anything from Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah. No, the action scenes are underwhelming as all get out. Like, and that's the other thing. It's like, again, we're going to keep going back to Batman because of, you know, that's the, you know, the reference point this movie's like using a lot of. But like Batman, even though there were like drama moments that maybe kids weren't tuned in for. Then like 5 minutes later, there was like an extended fight sequence of Batman going in and kicking ass. This, like, the fight sequences in this movie, like, are very brief. The action sequences are short. And this is the other stunning thing. I want to make sure I get to this. During the montages of Dick Tracy being successful, they underscore them with Sondheim ballads.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you're supposed to feel like it's like wistful and sad while Dick Tracy's like knocking dudes out.
Yeah.
That's insane.
I feel like this was okay. I feel like there's an aspect of this movie that when they made this, we're like, we're going to hit this nostalgia, you know, this nostalgia bone with the people who loved this comic, right? Like, they saw with Batman that they obviously hit a certain demographic. So I don't know if like they just hadn't nailed that yet, or they thought like, I feel like they were though trying to market that. They were trying to hit nostalgia with people, but didn't know how to do it and didn't have the formula to do it. And then in a panic, we're like, we must also pull children into this or else we're really going to flop.
Mm-hmm. They assumed that Dick Tracy was as beloved of a character as Batman.
They did not.
And one is an iconic comic book crime fighting superhero in a costume and cape with like seemingly mystical magical powers, and the other is a jacked up version of the man with the yellow hat
who talks into his wristwatch.
Yes. Yeah. Like that's no, like there's nothing. And okay, can we get into this now? Dick Tracy is not good at his job.
No.
he is a bad detective. He is a bad police officer. He is like, there's nothing fun about him. Like, he doesn't, he's like dirty. He's like, all of this is like, all the influences that Warren Beatty's pulling from are things that kids wouldn't want to see. Like, he's like Dirty Harry. He is wiretapping people. He's torturing people. He's getting forced confessions. He's setting, like, he's doing all of like, he keeps like having people around him say, You can't do that. You can't just like arrest a dude for no good reason, or you can't, you know, that's coercion. And he's like, I don't care. I'm getting results and whatever. And like kids are like kids watching this thinking, he's really sticking it to the system there. No, like it's such an odd idea. And by the way, so the whole plot of this movie revolves around, part of the plot of this movie revolves around him wanting to get Breathless Mahoney to testify, right?
Right.
The world's greatest detective has in his stead a young man who in the first scene witnesses a murder and it's never brought up. You literally have the witness that you need right there. The kid never mentions, hey, you know what? I saw Flat Top straight up murder 5 dudes.
Wait, you said world's greatest detective. Batman was in Dick Tracy?
Right.
The bad thing is, like, we don't have a city.
You when you fell asleep, Jay.
Gotta that go back. Sounds awesome.
Rewatch the movie.
I think the moral of this story is that what everyone should do is, after this, go look up Cool World and watch that, because that movie knows exactly what it is. There's no,
it's just as confused. You are
not going to come on flashbacks anymore. Okay, obviously this movie has not aged well. It has not. It has got great performances. Watch it for those reasons. It's got a great soundtrack that we're going to talk about here in a second. But let's talk about the impact. Before we start talking about the soundtrack, which we're just going to let Lou go on his soapbox, and we're going to try to make sure that someone's going to be able to take him off. Jay, that's all you. Let's talk about the marketing, because this movie, if there's one thing this movie did really well and the impact that it had, is just the toys. When I put the status on that we were doing this, a colleague of mine that I work with took a snapshot of a toy that he still has in the package of Dick Tracy from the movie. So, I mean, the impact for some people that really resonated with them when it came to them as a kid, it's still with them. I mean, I could still tell you what that watch was. So, I mean, impact, the marketing on this movie was definitely spot on. Anybody else?
I think, you know, I mentioned Sin City earlier. I think it did have, although it's been a long time, I do think there's an impact with how it was filmed with some future comic book movies. Like I said, Sin City, 300, some of those where they're really trying to get the aesthetic of the comic book, make it feel like, I mean, this is where, you know, I think they got it. And, you know, we keep mentioning Batman. I think Batman did, but I think I feel more that connection with Batman because the animated show that followed than it, you know, I think it created more Batman stuff in the future for how it was filmed, where this one was trying to show that it comes from a comic. And I really, really did just like, this is, it's Sin City Light, you know, it's Sin City Junior. I really felt that they probably were pretty influenced on some of those movies we saw in like that, you know, mid 2000s up to now on how they're filming some stuff. So that's one impact that I think I took out of it. I don't know if you guys agree with that sentiment, but that's probably the biggest one is we can make these movies pretty and attractive and really cool looking. But we also need to make them engaging and not totally confused and battling with itself. So
I think they took some of it. I mean, it is definitely like one of the first, you know, you have Batman, but it's stylized more like Tim Burton, but this definitely is a stylized, you know, super or comic book movie. Sir. So, Aaron, what are your thoughts?
Like I said earlier, I liked it. I did it leave like some amazing impact on me? No, but when I watched it, I did appreciate where I could see how maybe other things like Jay was talking about, maybe Sin City or the like cinematic style of comic book movies as they progress, maybe draw off of this. And I appreciated seeing, I guess, what would have been a modern movie using the studio sets and kind of trying to make that work. But other than that, my biggest impact of this movie has been Lou's gift to us all with introducing us to the soundtrack today.
All right.
So I don't know.
This is it, Lou. The floor is yours.
All right. Well, first, before we move on there, the legacy, I think, to me is kind of a cynical one in that if you market something well enough, you can make a movie, you can get kids really into something before they realize they're not interested in something.
Right.
Because going back to what I said earlier, so many kids were excited for a Dick Tracy movie when like 3 months prior probably didn't even know who Dick Tracy was.
Like my brother had a Dick Tracy shirt and he didn't care about Dick Tracy.
But right. If you ask kids that were born in 2000, they have no idea.
Exactly. Yeah. So like it's a very narrow window. Dick Tracy mania swept the country for like, you know, a good 6 weeks in 1990. So it does show that, I guess, in to put it maybe in less cynical terms, it shows about how a movie's reach can be more than the movie itself. That if a studio believes in something, they can market it and really get people excited about the event. And they were kind of just dovetailing off of what Batman did. Now, ultimately, they made a quarter of what Batman did. So the movie, it does show the movie still has to be good for it to last longer. But this was a kind of a famous disappointment. They thought this movie was going to be as big as Batman. In fact, we talked about Gremlins on our Gremlins 2 podcast. We talked about how Warner Brothers intentionally put Gremlins 2 up against Dick Tracy to cut in to their opening weekend budget or take so that it wouldn't beat Batman's record of single biggest weekend. And the mind-blowing stat now in 2020 that like studios were worried that Dick Tracy was going to usurp Batman kind of blows my mind.
I didn't know Gremlins 2 was so cold-blooded.
Well, Warner Brothers. No, see, it's the sacrificial lamb. Warner Brothers put it out because they're like, it split the audience. So, like, Gremlins 2 underperforms. Dick Tracy underperforms. The winner of the box office of 1990 is Batman, because no one touches its crown. So, like, and you know, if I, again, I'll do a time machine. Anybody's wanting to go see Dick Tracy opening weekend, I'm shutting them off to Gremlins 2.
Now I go. See I go.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's what it is for me, because I don't know if this movie, I see what you're saying, Jay, that I think the aesthetic idea that they do is really cool. And I could see filmmakers being like, ooh, we should go back to that. Cause kids who grew up watching Dick Tracy, you know, 20 years later, you get Sin City or, you know, whatever. And, you know, they were probably influenced by it. So, if it influenced better movies, great. but it also does, like, it was kind of that whole thing of maybe why we didn't get a lot of more comic book movies in the 90s, because they were like, well, Batman worked. We don't really know why, because we tried Dick Tracy and it didn't work. And then it was like, well, look at your source. You, like, come on. But no, to me, the best thing to come out of this whole experience is the soundtrack that came along with it. So Madonna, as we mentioned earlier, Madonna being in the movie and wanting to follow in the footsteps of Batman, you know, with Prince having an accompanying album, Madonna releases an album called I'm Breathless. It features all of the songs that she sings in the film. So it's music from and inspired by Dick Tracy. The inspired part, we got to get into. this is the wildest thing. If you don't watch the movie, I get it. We haven't done a good job of convincing you to go back and revisit this. Do yourself a favor. Spend 45 minutes on Spotify or wherever you can stream and listen to this soundtrack, because it is bananas. Not only do you have the three Stephen Sondheim songs on here. So first off, a pop album in 1990 with three Stephen Sondheim songs is already like next level stuff. Then we get a series of like 30s and 40s style. Madonna's basically experimenting with styles. So she does a couple of like songs that sound right out of Chicago or Bob Fosse-esque numbers. It, one of which is the song called Hanky Panky, which sounds is exactly what you think it is about if you're listening or watching this right now.
Sex? Is it sex?
Fur on the desk.
What you need to know about this song is that there is a rhyme scheme, and one of the rhymes in there with Hanky Panky is spanky. So if that's how you jump off that Spotify playlist,
that's the Al Pacino part.
Yep.
A spanker.
Tell me there's audio clips of him in that song.
There is not, but you're closer to the ballpark than you may want to be, Jay. So that song is about Madonna singing about, you know, liking to get a little spanking every once in a while. Look, everybody do your own thing. I don't know if I'd put it in my soundtrack to accompany the Disney movie that I'm starring in, but you know, 1990 Madonna, do whatever. Proving that point is the next is another song on this called Let's Go Bananas. And it is a Carmen Miranda-esque number. For those, if you remember the singer, complete with a full on Latina accent.
Mm-hmm.
She is singing the entire song with an accent. It is, I don't even know the words for it. I want to say bananas, but that's in the song. I think I'm,
I didn't even know it was her at first. I had to like stop and really be like, is this her doing a Cuban or a Latina accent? Like what is this? And it is her.
It is her.
Sounds very respectful of those cultures.
Yes. Then, oh, we're not done. We got more, folks. Then we move on, and we get one of the songs from the film, Now I'm Following You, is sung in a duet form with Madonna and her boyfriend slash co-star, Warren Beatty. Warren Beatty sings on this album, folks. That happened. In 1990, he sang on it.
And did he sing really well?
He's fine. He sounds like he's like your basic white dad at a karaoke. He's doing
it's like
well, that sounds like me, so he must be pretty damn good.
It's like entry level Sinatra. Like he's just like
he's like kind of talk singing his way.
Yeah. He's talking enough he's making enough sounds so it sounds like singing. And it's not wholly off key, but it's not, I mean, it's not a vocal performance. Let's get. But in case it was, that's not enough for you. We then go straight from that song into a remix of that exact same song. Madonna had the balls, and I use balls lovingly because no one had balls like 1990 Madonna. Madonna has the balls to not only do a duet with Warren Beatty, but to do a remix of that duet with Warren Beatty, put it on the same album right after the original song. No one could do that. No one could do that. But 1990 Madonna and the cherry on top of all of this. The very last song on the album is Vogue.
Yes.
One of her biggest hits and most iconic songs is at the tail end of this batshit insane soundtrack that she's like, you know what? I know this is a mess. These 11 tracks, this is a mess. I'm going to slip this one in there and watch me sell a million albums. And guess what? She sold 2 million albums. This was the second. This charted at number 2 on the Billboard. This Stephen Sondheim, Carmen Miranda, Warren Beatty duet mishmash of an album was the second highest goddamn album in the country.
Whoever set that up was no fool.
No.
Marketing.
Marketing. But no, but not even that. It's ingenious because everyone's going to go buy that album for Vogue. There's literally no, I mean, unless you are a diehard Sondheim fan and you got to have the whole canon.
You had no choice but to buy an album for that one song you wanted.
And not only that, if you bought that shit on tape, you had to fast forward through it, or you had to listen to the whole goddamn thing to get to Vogue. And the song that precedes it is the Warren Beatty remix. So if you're fast forwarding and you don't want to overshoot, you want to make sure you are guaranteed to hear at least 20 seconds of the Warren Beatty remix. Which
and the Warren Beatty remix starts sounding strangely like a Fresh Prince of Bel-Air remix.
It does. Oh, it's super, super early 90s. It's got that early 90s flavor to it.
Yes.
And it has clips from the film, Jay, so you might enjoy that. It does work in some quotes. It also then features the very cheeky line of Madonna going, "Dick, that's such an interesting name," and a remix of her just saying the name Dick a dozen times in a row.
I told Lou. Go ahead, Lou. Sorry.
So it's just Dick, 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 something like just.
I'm telling y'all, people, if you want to be enlightened, look it up. I told Lou that I have found enlightenment after I listened to that song, and I will never be the same.
I was listening to it on the couch and laughing, and my husband was sitting on the couch opposite of me making disdainful faces. Like, what are you doing? And I was explaining to him, I'm like, this soundtrack, the best way I could describe this, going through this soundtrack and how different it is in every track, is I'm like, I feel like I'm 12 and I'm at Great America and I'm walking through the different territories, like waiting for my keychain picture to be printed out. And it's like every time you go into a new territory, there's like new music with that territory. Like I'm in Orleans Place. Now I'm in Yukon territory. Now I'm in Harbor Place.
It's the Epcot Center of albums.
It's so weird.
Through the prism of one very rich white woman.
I need to make it
as it should be.
So with the remix song, so I didn't have time to. I was cleaning up glass. I didn't have time to shift gears to the album. It's like the same thing. Same thing as cleaning up glass. Mm-hmm. With or without gloves. Was he rapping on the remix? Is that what you're...
No, they take his pseudo-singing from the original.
Oh, okay.
And they put it to a 90s hip-hop beat.
This was pre-Bullworth, man.
That's what I was going. Honestly, I was like, was this prep work for Bullworth? And that's what it was.
This may have been... He may have heard that. He heard this album and was like, I could do this.
I know what I should do with my career.
Yeah, I could rap. I think, I 9 years later, we get Bullworth.
Oh, man.
Long I'm way from Bonnie and Clyde and Nick Cave and Mrs. Miller.
Oh, my gosh. I cannot. And the album is, the album cover is Warren Beatty in full Dick Tracy trench coat, like just like sniffing Madonna, kind of.
Well, they were dating.
They were dating. So, I mean, again, whatever. They were, it is not, and like, it's the cherry on top of the Warren Beatty vanity project. This is like, it was fine that he walked, like he doesn't do much in Hollywood. Like he does Bugsy, I think the next year. And then after that, it's like, okay, Warren, let's chill.
Let's dial it back.
Yeah. That he gets to not only like do this movie, but also get to be on a hit record, which you know he got residuals for.
Yeah. Oh man. I want people to listen to this. You need to. Lou, thank you for finding it. First of all,
that's what I do.
Because impact wise, this soundtrack gave us Vogue. If we did not have the Dick Tracy soundtrack, we would not have Vogue.
Yeah. That's honestly, that is the biggest thing that this whole movie did. Vogue and its dance, like it honestly, I don't know how, yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. That's the biggest cultural impact of this movie is that song.
Right.
That has nothing to do with the film.
Right. So before we wrap up, is there anything else that we want to talk about in terms of impact before we turn it over to Lou to do his guilty pleasure meter?
Got a couple of rapid notes I want to hit real quick.
Okay.
First of all, we don't talk about Dick Van Dyke's in this movie. He looks like the Penguin and he separates his shoulder in his death scene. James Caan shows up. So we get a Godfather reunion between him and Al Pacino, only to have his car blow up a la... what was supposed to happen to Michael Corleone. You mentioned the blank. I really appreciated the Scooby-Doo-esque nature of let's find out who you really are.
Pull right off this person's face. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he was nervous about touching it.
He's a perfect
Madonna coughed as it happened too. So I don't know if that's
oh my God! Hold on, can we talk
new
about
hernia.
She dies at the end, right? Like she dies after that kiss.
Yes.
Yes.
I watched when I saw that. I was like, oh my God, that is so the Rise of Skywalker kiss.
I need to
boom impact.
I'm like I'm done.
And then the last thing is that the kid changes his name to Dick Tracy Jr. during the film. But at the end, he gets his own little wristwatch and they get called off on the next crime. So is the kid a cop now? Is that how that works in this town?
He did have a certificate.
It's a kid's movie. Obviously, he's a cop.
And yes. There were laws and regulations for policing.
You're a deputy. You're a deputy. Let's go round them up.
Kids fit in tiny places, okay?
Mm-hmm. That and what the hell is Mandy Patinkin doing in this movie?
Playing the piano and trying to sing with Madonna.
And then having like some sort of weird laughing fit. Like,
oh,
like
yeah.
What was like his performance is insane.
I would like
he does that. Weird stuff though. He does he's in Elmo and Grouchland. He's the big actor in that feature film.
And I guess what I mean is stuff. I understand why he's in the movie because he's a great singer and performer and can sing Sondheim very, very well. That I don't begrudge. What I mean is what is his choices in the film are just all over the map. I can't understand it. Like, he's some scenes he's like doing, like he looks like he's into Madonna, but some scenes he's not.
And then you're right.
His look just looked like a frightened person. Just then.
Then he has the weird like Eddie Murphy laugh.
Yeah.
It's a lot. It's a lot. Okay. I think I got it all out of my system now.
Let's do guilty pleasure meter.
So we'll finish this off on the guilty pleasures meter here. On a scale of 1 to 5 shame spirals, 1 being you love this movie, you think everybody needs to see Dick Tracy, revisit Dick Tracy, you can't wait, all the way to 5 meaning you either hated this movie, Jay, or you, if you do like this movie, you couldn't in good conscience recommend it to anybody, you would just watch it alone by yourself. Where does Dick Tracy fall on the guilt meter? Aaron, let's start with you.
Okay, I enjoyed it, but I have no legitimate reason to really recommend it to anybody. So I'm going to go 4.
Wow. All right. Ryan, how about you?
I'm going to say that people that like aesthetically pleasing movies, I'm going to recommend it. And just that pure instance, people that also want to watch movies that are just batshit crazy, I'm also going to recommend this movie too, because this movie has no idea what it is. So I'm going to give it a 3.
And Jay, your thoughts?
Well, you underestimate the level of feelings I have for this movie, because you say I hate, but it actually just downright, this movie makes me angry. It's more than hate. I'm just I've been on edge in the house since watching this movie. So if I could go past 5, I would. Here's what I'll do. This is a movie I would suggest for fans of Cool World. I think if you like Cool World, you're going to dig Dick Tracy. But it's a hard 5 for me.
Shots fired.
Hard 5. Hard.
I think I got to go 3.5. Because I don't think this is a straight up bad movie. It's a confused movie, but I don't think a movie that looks as good as this, that has as much talent in this movie as this movie does, I don't think I could. I didn't watch it and think, well, this is really bad. I thought it's confused and it's muddled, and I don't think I'd need to see it again. So I couldn't recommend it to anybody, but I didn't outright like dislike or hate this movie. So I'm going to go I'm going to walk right up to the 4, but I'm going to dial it back to a 3.5, to say, yeah, I don't think there's any, if you need to like go scratch that nostalgic itch, I would say, you know, it's more beautiful than you probably remember, because it looks great in HD. It's on HBO Max now. So if you're subscribed to that, it's free. So you're not spending any money. Outside of that, no, I don't think we need to, if you're a comic book movie completist, you can skip this one.
Yeah, I think anybody born after 1993 is not going to care about this movie.
This feels like a movie that gets shown in film school to say you could have a big budget and a lot of talent and
blow it.
And blow it. And here's what was good about it, and here's what really sucked about it. And like, it's an example of that.
You have to know what your movie wants to do.
Yeah.
And I think it was like, not to get too like deep or anything, but I think Roger Ebert, when like he would give good reviews to like stupid comedies, they'd be like, well, you gave this 3 stars, but you also gave some prestige movie 3 stars. Are you saying they're as good? And he's like, no, this one's trying to do something and it succeeds at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dick Tracy doesn't succeed at the level it's shooting for, because it doesn't know what it wants to be.
Except Al Pacino.
Al Pacino knows what he's doing. He knows what he wants to do, and he does it.
That's right.
Sure he does.
Well, that's going to do it for us here at Front Row Network's Flashback. But before we go, we want to do our plugs, our shameless plugs, tell you what we got coming up, and, of course, all the places that you can find us. But first, we're going to talk about what we got coming up. I'm super excited. Next month is my month. I am beyond excited. Monster Cast, anything and everything horror. The Front Row is just going to come at you with show upon show, strictly dedicated to horror. Jay's going to let you know what we got coming up for flashbacks.
Yeah, in October on Front Row Flashbacks, we're going to be covering Return of the Living Dead for its 35th anniversary, as well as The Shining for its 40th anniversary. And if we have some time, we might try to squeeze one more in there with Lighthouse. So that's what we got coming up. Return of the Living Dead, The Shining, and we're going to try to squeeze Lighthouse in. We got a few other things down the chute that we're working on as well that, well, Aaron can tell you about another side project we got going.
All right, Aaron, go ahead.
Yeah, so we are doing, we're getting a little bit more into the streaming shows and talking about some of those. So right now we're doing a Flashbacks Presents kind of sidebar show about the series on HBO Max, Raised with Wolves. That's me and Jay. We've been talking about it. We've only done the first two episodes and we're doing two episodes a week. So feel free to jump on in on that. We're really enjoying it. So
awesome. Lou, what do you got coming for Guilty Pleasures?
Well, depending on when you hear this and when it's dropping in the feed, I know 2 days from the recording of this, I'll say, I'm recording an episode with the hosts of the Double Team podcast, or Double Threat podcast, excuse me. And we're going to be talking about Rhinestone from 1984, Dolly Parton, Sylvester Stallone, country music, Pygmalion adaptation. What more do you need? I'm excited to talk to them about that. And then my MonsterCast contribution for Guilty Pleasures, it's at least one of them, is going to be celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Eddie Murphy, Wes Craven collaboration, Vampire in Brooklyn. So that's very exciting. I'm not done with 1990, by the way. I'm not even done with Al Pacino in 1990, because by the end of the year, I know that Brandon and Eric and I are going to get back together for Guilty Pleasures and talk Godfather 3 just in time for the recut that's supposed to be coming out in December. I also know we're going to be talking in no particular order. We're going to be talking about Mortal Kombat and Xanadu. So we got lots of fun stuff coming up for the rest of the year.
Awesome, Lou. Thank you. That's going to do it for us. You guys can catch us on NPR Illinois at with the Community Voices tab. You can catch us on Twitter. Lou, what's your Twitter handle for Guilty Pleasures?
You can find me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hare, or you can find me on Instagram, Lou Hare.
Okay. And Flashbacks now has a Facebook site or a Facebook page. It's got a Instagram page that we're slowly trying to work on. Of course, you can catch all of our feeds on the Front Row Network's main page on Facebook. So go ahead and check us out. But more importantly, we are now starting a Patreon. Please get on there and donate. And with that donation, you have the opportunity to have exclusive content, exclusive episodes. And of course, you might have the opportunity to be on a show with any show that you really want. You are our patrons. So please check us out on Patreon and be a part of our wonderful dysfunctional family. that is going to do it for us tonight. I am Ryan Lutens, and with me tonight has been
Jay Hoffman,
Lou Hare,
and Aaron McCabe.
Thank you so much, and we will see you in the front row.
Dick, that's an interesting name. Dick. My bottom hurts just thinking about it.